Welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Tony Hillerman, whose latest novel is The Wailing Wind. Tony Hillerman has also recently written a memoir, an autobiography, called Seldom Disappointed. Hillerman is the author of several novels featuring detectives Joe Leaphorn and Jim Chee, set in Navajo country. Tony Hillerman, before we get to The Wailing Wind, your latest book, I'd like to talk a little about your memoir. What prompted you to write a memoir?
I have an, elderly, mature editor named Larry Ashmead who wanted me to write a memoir, and I kept wiggling out of it because I didn't want to take on all that labor, and finally I decided I ought to. He kept bringing up grandchildren and stuff. And so once I got started, I sort of enjoyed it, to tell you the truth. I mean, writing it.
It's an interesting point at the end of Seldom Disappointed. You discuss a scene you're working on that you put aside for the writing of the book. And that scene is about halfway through Wailing Wind, maybe a little less than halfway through it, where Leaphorn is waiting for some people to show up at a diner. Question for you then, how does it feel to put a book down, a mystery that you're in the middle of writing, in order to write another book?
It's usually caused by desperation. You're working on a plotted novel, and you find your whole idea is not working. You know, you keep trying to make the muse arrive and tell you how to solve it, and you can't. And so you begin thinking of all the other things that you could be working on, it, and so the novel sets for a while, and you write something. That's what happened on this. I was going back and forth between them, and I do it all the time. It's because I can't seem to outline anything.
You mentioned in Seldom Disappointed that there was one serendipitous moment in one book where you're glad you didn't outline, because you had a dog in a car.
Yeah.
Can you talk
It was
talk
an early
that.
Book, too. Luckily, everybody sensible tells you that if you're going to write a novel that's plotted, you outline it, and thought, yeah, that makes sense. Why bother even to tell you? Everybody knows that. So I wasted untold hours trying to outline my first three books. Finally, each time I'd just start writing them, thinking maybe when I get to chapter three, I'll know where it's going. On that book, same thing. I hadn't been able to outline it. I got that far. And then when I came back to it, I was a professor then, and it was midterm time, and I'd been reading papers, and I'd left it aside for a while. Came back to it, got back to where I was, and I found this dog in the back of the car. And I'd intended to erase the dog. And I thought, you know, that dog could be useful. And so, you know, if anybody's read that book, you couldn't see I could possibly write that book without the dog in it. So right there then I thought, okay, no more wasting time trying to outline.
But what do you actually do? I mean, in a book like Wailing Wind, did you know who the killer was when you started the book?
Not really. I had two or three possibilities. I knew I was going to use this abandoned Army ammunition depot, because it just sets there beside the interstate highway and has for years and years and years, empty and just dying to be the setting for a book.
And it's a real place. It's Fort Wingate, right?
Yeah, Fort Wingate, yeah. 40 square miles and mostly filled with these immense empty ammunition bunkers where everything that blew up in Vietnam was stored there at one time, I guess. And I knew I was going to have some climax. Something important was going to happen in one of those bunkers.
That's all you knew?
Well, yeah. And so I was working toward it. I'd have somebody, a kidnap victim or a body left there, or who knows. I'd come up with something.
Well, when you were working on it, what direction did the book go in that you had to pull back on?
Which one? Or
this one.
I mean, which of the many that I have to pull back on? The beauty of a computer is you write the first two or three chapters, right? And then when you realize that X said this, but he should have said something different, you go back and you change the first chapter and have him say the proper things. And you take out the improper things. And, you know, you work your way laboriously through the book doing that. I was going to have some kids taking a shortcut through the off-limits fort to get down where they could hitchhike. I had to go back and change that several times, what they saw and what they heard. And then I said it'd be really weird if they heard some music, so I have to go back to Chapter 7 and add a birthday present. There's a lot of fiddling around done with getting a book finished properly, so you're finally decide, well, it's finished, and for heaven's sakes, quit writing on it, you know.
What about seldom disappointed? Did you have any of that, or did that flow more easily?
That flowed more easily. Once I got into World War II, then I found myself making phone calls to guys in my platoon and other people and borrowing some. I knew Army wouldn't let you keep a diary. Not that I would have anyway, I don't think, but a couple guys I knew in the company had, illegally, and they still had them, and I borrowed. They loaned me their diaries. And then I did a lot of research to find out who these darn Germans were we were up against all the time. It turned out it was an SS outfit that had transferred down from Norway, all fresh and ready to fight. Made me feel better that they whacked us so hard. Things like that. But generally, it flowed pretty well.
Well, you were an infantryman from landing in Marseille to finally, eventually winding up getting injured somewhere in Germany.
Actually, yeah, in France.
It was right on the border?
Close. It was in Alsace.
It sounds as if you virtually walked the entire way. That would be half the length of France.
We virtually did. Once in a while, we'd get a ride on a truck. But basically, we walked through the Vosges Mountains and then up and down because they would transfer. And we got a lot of truck rides, but we did infantry, you're supposed to be able to do 25 miles with 60 pounds on your back in 8 hours. You have great thigh muscles after a while.
After you got out of the infantry, you became a reporter. You went back to school and then became a reporter and worked for various papers as well as for the UP. And you talk about how you met someone, a sheriff, while you were a reporter, who became the basis for Joe Leaphorn.
Yeah, oddly enough, a young guy, I still think of him as sort of if all police were like him, it'd be a wonderful world. Very wise, humane guy, and a good cop, and I thought right then, if I ever have, write of this kind of book, and I need a cop, a good cop, he's it.
You also mentioned that when you named Leaphorn, you didn't realize that that was not a Navajo name and had nothing to do with Indians at all.
No, it doesn't. It has something to do with a bull from the sea or whatever the name of Mary Renault's book about the pre-Greek cowboys. Anyway, he was going to be a very minor character in that book. And I just needed a cop as a source of information for the principal character. When I needed I don't know if other writers do, have books everywhere around my office and a row of them over my head. And I'm wanting a name, can't think, want to look up there and you name a guy Webster or Bartlett or, right off the back of one of your reference books. Random House. One guy's named Random, the other guy's named House, right? Oh, wow. And then when it finally dawned on me when I was doing another book about Navajos, this was totally non-Navajo name, and there's plenty of good Navajo names you could use. From that point on, they're all real Navajo names, people I know or people I've run into or something.
Did any Navajos ever complain about the fact that Leaphorn's name was...
No.
Nobody ever did.
No. They're not sensitive about names. When I was an investigative reporter once, looking into license plate frauds, I found a Navajo who had gotten paid for a... I won't go into detail, but the name he had assigned to himself was Afraid of His Horse. I like that. They have a secret name, their religious name, nobody really knows that except people very close to them. The guy that named them when they were a baby, or the woman who did, and usually close family members.
Tony Hillerman, I get the sense from reading Seldom Disappointed that a Navajo could never get away with writing mysteries set in Navajo country because they'd be afraid of giving too much away, whereas you can say whatever you want.
That's kind of based on a misunderstanding. All of the Pueblo tribes have a tradition deep-rooted, and it probably came from the earliest years in Spanish conquest of that part of the country when they were trying to convert them all to Christianity. They have a very deep-rooted and well-guarded idea, dedication to keeping a lot of things secret, relative specific to their religion. For example, a Zuni, who may be a member of one religious society and have a brother in another one, they won't pass the information back and forth. It's only to be known by one initiated to know it, and the distribution of it weakens the power and the force of the ceremony. But the Navajos, they have a totally different and extremely abstract religious system. for example, a curing ceremonial. Some of them now have adopted some of those, married into Pueblo tribes, and some Navajos are secretive about some stuff, partly because they think I'll get it wrong anyway. But most of them know that once they find that you're seriously interested in, you ask them a question, they'll give you an honest answer.
Well, now having written all these books, how do you feel about having made that particular choice to be involved and to be basically known as a writer of
Navajo?
Yeah.
I'm absolutely, totally, totally content. I think they've got a wonderful culture, and they are extremely good people in terms of having a great sense of humor, for one thing. They can see humor and find a way to make a pun or a joke out of almost anything. And they're utterly, absolutely non-materialistic. In fact, as their origin story will tell you, when they having too much money, too much anything, is a sign that you're really not a very good person, because you're surrounded by, you know, a culture that has a 40-something percent unemployment rate, and hardly anybody's got more than they need. And they rarely, I don't know of any Navajos who operates their own trading post. You know, here I've got all these shelves full of food, and I've got hungry clansmen and kinsfolks out there. It's wrong, right? So I like the culture, and I'm happy that I hope to think that I made more people aware of it.
You created Jim Chee for two reasons. One reason is that he was appropriate for the book. The book you're writing, Leaphorn would never have been as ignorant of white ways for the book. But the other reason was because you'd sold off rights to Leaphorn.
Accidentally. Oh, yeah. My great adventures with the movie industry started with the very first book, and Warner Brothers optioned it, and it came out in a paperback saying, soon to be a major motion picture, as I recall. And years later, it's, how many years later? 30-something years later, it still hadn't become a major motion picture. Then Dance All the Dead got optioned by another outfit, and they got me to write a screenplay, which I did. I really learned something about movies. I never was a movie fan, so I went to see a movie with a little notebook, and it was a Thomas Crown Affair. I still remember it. Haven't seen many movies since then. 9 minutes in the movie, I still had not heard a spoken word. I thought, hell, this ought to be easy. I was wrong. Anyway, they paid me for the movie script, but they never used it. Years later, somebody else optioned it. They didn't know that they had a script already written, so they took me out to Hollywood to write a treatment for them, which never, ever produced anything except good story.
But eventually they owned the rights, and you had to buy them back for, what, $20,000?
Yeah, they owned
the rights to the name. Now, I understand that there was a movie that came out, though it never actually got released in theaters.
Based on A Dark Wind. I was cast as a warden in that one, at three lines, muffed them repeatedly, so they cut it to two lines. When they looked at the finished product, they cut out that whole section of film.
Did you ever see, that's with Lou Diamond Phillips as Jim Chee. Did you ever see the movie, the completed film?
Yeah, I saw the what they call a rough cut. Robert Redford was involved in it. And he'd gone off, I guess, to Havana to make Havana, wherever they made it. And when he got back and saw it, wasn't really, shall we say, enthusiastic about it, and he contacted me, would I want my name taken off of it? Would I take a look at the rough cut or whatever it was? And so I looked at it, and it was about what I expect. Some of it was good, and some of it was hard for me to understand. Since I'd written the book, I thought maybe it'd make it hard for everybody else to understand. Anyway, he didn't release it. It wasn't released, whoever has control over that in the States. It was in France and England and got fairly good reviews. And then it came out in an audio tape, videotape.
Is it available now in video then? Have you seen it in the stores and stuff?
I have. I don't know if it still is.
How's Phillips as Chee?
Pretty good, really. He was also a real gentleman. After I'd blown the lines about four times, and I was feeling downcast, and they were looking at me like I was some kind of idiot, he patted me on the shoulder, and he says, well, Mr. Hillerman, they probably couldn't write a book.
You're listening to an interview with Tony Hillerman, whose latest novel is The Wailing Wind. I understand that Skinwalkers is now being turned into a TV movie.
That's what I'm told. The way way the writer learns about these things is that you get a call from a cop out on Navarro Place, and he says, ask me if, how come they're filming that thing west out near Phoenix? instead of up here where we live. And I said, what thing? And they said, the movie they're making on her. And I say, what? Who's making it and what's the movie? See? And so then I call my agent. Did my agent know about it? Well, vaguely, maybe. And finally, then, Jamie Redford, Robert's son, called me and said, golly, I want to apologize. Somebody should have told you about this. He wrote the script, I guess, or one version of it. You know, they tinker with these things endlessly, and the director's got... But they tell me that they hope to start a new mystery series on PBS, starting it with It.
So you have no idea what the script is like or how close
it
is or anything?
I've seen a script that Jamie Redford wrote years ago when they first were thinking about making it. And then they sent me the new one, and I read part of it, and it looked like, I don't know who revised it, but it looked like it was going to be all right, and so I quit. I got doing something else. I haven't read it all. Read about half of it.
You don't plan on writing more screenplays or adapting anything like Wailing Wind?
No, I've got another book that's stuck in the fifth, sixth chapter that I'm working on now. Would be working on now if I was home.
When you say stuck, it means that you're...
It means I don't have the slightest idea what to do next.
You have another character who's popped up now in three straight books, Bernadette, a female cop.
Bernadette Manuelito, yeah. Well, Bernadette, as the end, when you read Wailing Wind, you see right at the end that she has a pretty good reason to want to leave the Navajo Tribal Police. Two of them, in fact. One of them, she's working for her boss is Jim Chi, and she has concluded that she is one of these very moral, ethical fellows who feels like it would be inappropriate for him to make romantic moves with his hired hand. See, and then funny how you get people. Come to your rescue. A woman calls me. She said, why don't you have, if Bernie's going to leave she'd been in customs service. If she's going to leave the Navajo Tribal Police, why don't you recruit her into something called a Shadow Wolf, a border patrol outfit that's all Indian trackers. And then somebody else had been in customs, was a friend of hers. And I heard from her, and she gave me some other ideas about another plot. So now Bernadette is principal character in this next book. At least she is as of now. It may change because I may find it, you know, maybe I'll find it. I was made a mistake when I quit out trying to outline.
In Wailing Wind, you have a very wealthy guy named Wiley Denton. Now, I'm curious. He came across very fleshed out. Is that based on a real person?
Not exactly, but most of my characters are based on bits and pieces of real people. We had a lieutenant governor who later became governor and was appointed to, as I recall, to this, well, way back, I'm not sure. Well, anyway, real nice guy, and also a guy whose biography would be a little bit like Wiley Denton's. He made a heck of a lot of money in the oil business, actually natural gas business, now dead. But I had him in mind, and then I had a distant relative who was a lease buyer, now dead, and some other oil patch. I grew up my brother was a well logger and an oil person. So I sort of stuck them together.
You wrote a book called Hunting Badger a couple of years back in which the FBI plays a not very kind role and incompetent role, actually. You talk about it in Seldom Disappointed. And now after September 11th, 2001, we discover the FBI was even more incompetent than we could possibly imagine.
Well, they weren't any more incompetent than they had been in the case. Just in the background in this one, because hard to be. They were so incompetent that we had some resignations from people in the agency who were just embarrassed by it. I started out as a journalist and as a police reporter. And I've known a lot of FBI agents, and the ones who actually are out there working tend to be bright guys and hard workers, and I like them, you know. Used to play bridge with one, and he was always beating me. But the problem is, after you get up closer to Washington, higher up the rank, a sort of a mental numbness sets in. And in this pushing books, you know, you do a lot of book signings, a lot of cops read my books, and I've made a habit of always saying, am I too hard on the FBI? And they say, let me tell you, and then I hear the working police, the city police, the county police, the state police, hardly any of them who've been working in the business long don't have some horrible story about the incompetence of what happens to information when it gets, what we're saying now, I guess, in the computer. This old notion that knowledge is power seemed to be deeply ingrained in the FBI. And in this case here, after that book was written, Hunting Badger, a woman I know in Bluff, she said, television put out an FBI, if you know about any of these killers, if you, some of you people know them or see, call this FBI information number. They set up a special line. So she said, I'm out there hanging up my laundry, and there goes this truck by. Said, I knew that there was two of these guys they were hunting for, driving a truck. I recognized the truck. I knew the man. So I rush in and call that FBI number. The road they're going up, it's in southern Utah, really rough, mountainous, empty country. Said it's a dead-end road. It road goes up that canyon, and finally it branches off a couple of hogans and stuff, and that's the end of it, dead end. So I rushed and called the FBI, and then I sat on the porch, said, any minute now I'll be seeing, here'll come the fuzz, they'll catch them. Nobody came. Got up the next morning, sat on the porch, waiting for the, nobody came. I think it was the third day, here came a couple of sheriff's cars. The information went into the FBI box, and it didn't ever come out. And that's the complaint you hear a lot. Well, same story. Somebody finds tracks. Here, the word gets the FBI. Here comes the FBI copters and blows the tracks off. And then, of course, the FBI offered that $250,000 reward. So here comes the bounty hunters flagging in. And the next thing you know, the FBI is telling them all to go home. Anyway, it's a lot of really good people in the FBI, but the Washington office, they're all patronage guys.
So when you hear about what happened September 11th, that's not surprising.
Oh, no. I didn't surprise any cop, any sheriff or police chief, you know, city cops. They'd think, well, better make a novena or go to mass or say some prayers here because we're counting on the CIA or the FBI. We're in bad trouble here. And turns out, of course, they were. Oh, well, at my age, I'm full of prejudices, and this is no place to be airing them. I guess maybe it is, though, isn't it?
It probably is. Tony Hillerman, in reading Seldom Disappointed, you were a professor of journalism for many years, and you were a journalist for many years. I'd like to ask you, since that was back in the 50s and 60s, what do you see print journalism, the differences between the print journalism of today and what you saw back then?
Well, I think it's more entertainment-oriented. I mean, you see more, we used to have two kinds, we called them, pig iron was the important stuff, and then the human interest stuff. See? And you don't see as much pig iron now. You don't see as much of the kind of stories you need to know whether you should ought to be voting for Joe or Bill, or you don't see enough of the stories explaining the Patriot Act. What's that going to do to your civil rights? Does that mean the right of habeas corpus is maybe not quite as secure as it once was? Nobody's doing that the way they used to as much. So I'm kind of, but you know, I'm 77, and people, after they get past a certain age, get to be what you call curmudgeons, grumps, grouchy old men. Well, I've got a long list of things I'm grouchy about. In other words, I'm seldom satisfied, in addition to being seldom disappointed.
But on the other hand, you have all that experience, and the question is, are they teaching journalists now the way they taught them then?
I don't know, because I've gotten out of the business, 20-some years ago, I guess. A lot of journalism schools haven't even changed their name. They're focusing on so many of their students want to go into television or radio, and as opposed to being a, what we call an ink-stained wretch. Overworked and poorly paid. I see a lot of things on television that I think maybe they ought to start having IQ tests. For example, our state is just immersed in a terrible drought, and our weather people, until a few days ago, were saying, good news, another bright, sunny weekend, when everybody in the whole darn state is on their knees praying for rain, you know? Oh, well.
I think it's important when we see how it was done before and how it's done now. And I look at it, I look at the news, I look at what I'm seeing, and I question the competence. And it's got to start somewhere. It's got to start somewhere. As a writer, do you see any difference in the writing? Do you think the writing is as good? No,
I don't think it is. But again, you know, you ask my age, I frankly hardly ever see, no matter what I'm reading, even I just finished reading stuff, H.L. Mencken, who wrote The American Language, and let's face it, a hell of a good writer. And I'm saying, oh, I would have taken out that modifier, and I would have reversed that, you know, you can't see a sentence that you couldn't improve.
How important do you think is it to have learned those journalistic skills before becoming a novelist?
Tremendously. Boy, I tried to figure out, when somebody asked me, how much had you written before you wrote fiction? And I tried to figure it up. Once with UP, I was a union man. I figured I'd written about, for money, about 8 million words. That's a lot of words, you know, because every day you drowned out a lot of stories. And you learn what you can do. You learn how to describe a scene in a courtroom in a few words. You learn how to describe the sorrow of a murder victim's mother. You meet all kind of people too. You're not up the ivory tower. You're out there on the street. You're at a train wreck. You can see how the crew responds to a train wreck. It's just covered well. For example, in one of my scenes, developing a character, came right out of a long interview I had with a guy that was going into the gas chamber that night.
Right.
You know, and sort of thing you don't normally get.
What about perception and memory? Do you think that it helped you in terms of being able to walk into a room and see what's going on?
Yeah, because all of a sudden you think, hey, this could be useful. You're looking for those details, little details. Gum under the edge of a table tells you something about the room. What's in the wastebasket? Were the windows washed? You know, you things that'll tell you something. Or you're talking to a friend, maybe. I think I might mention this in that seldom disappointed. This friend of mine who was long, had a real close and long marriage, and his wife had died. And I was asking, how do you deal with that? And he's telling me what he's done. And one thing, he changed the side of the bed he sleeps on. Because he'd wake up every morning, and first thing I did, I reached my hand out, and now I reach it out into a vacuum. She's not there. And then I start the day down, gloomy, depressed. So I moved over where I reach out my hand. It drops right off the bed, you know. And he stops and he says, Hillerman, you son of a bitch, you're going to use that, aren't you? And I said, well, yes. Oh, you don't waste anything. You know, you're always looking for stuff.
And you got that from those years as a reporter.
Yeah, because you're basically with a wire service, you're covering something, and you're not going to go to a typewriter and write it. You're going to run to a telephone and dictate it. See, so you're looking for the crucial things. In other words, yeah, I think it's an excellent training ground for anybody, whatever you're going to write.
You've been listening to an interview with Tony Hillerman, whose latest novel is The Wailing Wind. Also available, his memoir, Seldom Disappointed. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.